I have changed, Soldrin. He grinned. But no, I haven't got any older. He looked Beishai in the eye. They'd give you this too if you asked them. The culture would let you grow younger, then stabilize your age, or let you grow old again, but very slowly.
Bribery, Zakalwe?
Beishai said, smiling. Hey, it was just a thought. And it'd be a payment, not a bribe. And they wouldn't force it on you. But it's academic anyway. He paused, nodding into the sky. Completely academic now. Here comes a plane. Soldrin looked out to the red clouds of sunset. He couldn't see any aircraft.
A culture one?
Beishai asked cautiously. He smiled. In the circumstances, Soldrin, if you can see it, it isn't a culture one. He turned and walked quickly, picking up the suit helmet and putting it on. Suddenly, the dark figure became inhuman behind the armoured, sensor-studded faceplate of the suit. He took a large pistol from the suit holster. Soldrin! His voice came booming from speakers set in the suit chest as he checked the settings on the gun. If I were you, I'd get back to the capsule or just plain run away and hide. The figure turned to face Beishai, the helmet like the head of some gigantic, fearsome insect. I'm fixing to give these assholes a fight, just for the sheer hell of it. And it might be best for you if you weren't nearby. Numeral 4. The ship was over 80 kilometres long, and it was called the Size Isn't Everything. The last thing he'd been on for any length of time had actually been bigger. But then, that had been a tabular iceberg big enough to hide two armies on, and it didn't beat the General Systems vehicle by much. How do these things hold together? He stood on a balcony, looking out over a sort of miniature valley composed of accommodation units. Each stepped terrace was smothered in foliage. The space was crisscrossed by walkways and slender bridges, and a small stream ran through the bottom of the V. People sat at tables in little courtyards, lounged on the grass by the stream side, or amongst the cushions and couches of cafes and bars on the terraces. Hanging above the centre of the valley, beneath a ceiling of glowing blue, a travel tube snaked away into the distance on either side, following the wavy line of the valley. Under the tube, a line of fake sunlight burned, like some enormous strip light. Hmm? Dizziet Smar said, arriving at his elbow with two drinks. She handed one to him. They're too big, he said. He turned to face the woman. He'd seen the things they called bays, where they built smaller spaceships. Smaller, in this case, meant over 3 kilometres long. Vast, unsupported hangars with thin walls. He'd been near the immense engines, which as far as he could gather were solid and inaccessible. How? And obviously extremely massive. He'd felt oddly threatened on discovering that there was no control room, no bridge, no flight deck anywhere in the vast vessel. Just three minds, fancy computers apparently, controlling everything. What? And now he was finding out where the people lived. But it was all too big, too much, too flimsy somehow. Especially if the ship was supposed to accelerate as smartly as Smar claimed. He shook his head. I don't understand. How does it hold together? Smar smiled. Just think fields, Sharadanin. It's all done with force fields. She put one hand out to his troubled face, patted one cheek. Don't look so confused, and don't try to understand it all too quickly. Let it soak in. Just wander around. Lose yourself in it for a few days. Come back whenever. Later, he had wandered off. The huge ship was an enchanted ocean in which you could never drown, and he threw himself into it to try to understand, if not it, then the people who had built it. He walked for days, stopping at bars and restaurants whenever he felt thirsty, hungry or tired. Mostly they were automatic, and he was served by little floating trays, though a few were staffed by real people. They seemed less like servants and more like customers who'd taken a notion to help out for a while. Of course I don't have to do this, one middle-aged man said, carefully cleaning the table with a damp cloth. He put the cloth in a little pouch, sat down beside him. But look, this table's clean. He agreed that the table was clean. Usually, the man said, I work on alien, no offence, alien religions, directional emphasis in religious observance, that's my speciality.
like when temples or graves or prayers have to face in a certain direction, that sort of thing. Well, I catalogue, evaluate, compare. I come up with theories and argue with colleagues here and elsewhere. But the job's never finished. Always new examples, and even the old ones get re-evaluated and new people come along with new ideas about what you thought was settled. But, he slapped the table, when you clean a table, you clean a table. You feel you've done something, it's an achievement. But in the end, it's still just cleaning a table. And therefore it does not really signify on the cosmic scale of events, the man suggested. He smiled in response to the man's grin. Well, yes. But then, what does signify? My other work? Is that really important either? I could try composing wonderful musical works or day-long entertainment epics. But what would that do? Give people pleasure? My wiping this table gives me pleasure, and people come to a clean table which gives them pleasure. And anyway, the man laughed, people die, stars die, universes die. What is any achievement, however great it was, once time itself is dead? Of course, if all I did was wipe tables, then of course it would seem a mean and despicable waste of my huge intellectual potential. But because I choose to do it, it gives me pleasure. And, the man said with a smile, it's a good way of meeting people. So, where are you from anyway? He talked to people all the time, in bars and cafes mostly. The GSV's accommodation seemed to be divided into various different types of layout. Valleys, or ziggurats, if you wanted to look at them like that, seemed to be the most common, though there were different configurations. He ate when he was hungry, and drank when he was thirsty, every time trying a different dish or drink from the stunningly complicated menus, and when he wanted to sleep, as the whole vessel gradually cycled into a red-tinged dusk, the ceiling light bars dimming, he just asked the drone and was directed to the nearest unoccupied room. The rooms were all roughly the same size, and yet all slightly different. Some were very plain, some were highly decorated. The basics were always there. Bed, sometimes a real physical bed, sometimes one of their weird field beds. Somewhere to wash and defecate. Cupboards, places for personal effects, a fake window, a hollow screen of some sort, and a link-up to the rest of the communications net, both aboard and off-ship. The first night away, he linked into one of their direct-link sensory entertainments, lying on the bed with some sort of device activated under the pillow. He did not actually sleep that night. Instead, he was a bold pirate prince who'd renounced his nobility to lead a brave crew against the slaver ships of a terrible empire amongst the spice and treasure isles. Their quick little ships darted amongst the lumbering galleons, picking away the rigging with chainshot. They came ashore on moonless nights, attacking the great prison castles, releasing joyous captives. He personally fought the wicked governor's chief torturer, sword against sword. The man finally fell from a high tower. An alliance with a beautiful lady pirate begot a more personal liaison, and a daring rescue from a mountain monastery when she was captured. He pulled away from it after what had been weeks of compressed time. He knew, somewhere at the back of his mind, even as it happened, that none of it was real, but that seemed like the least important property of the adventure. When he came out of it, surprised to discover that it had not actually ejaculated during some of the profoundly convincing erotic episodes, he discovered that only a night had passed, and it was morning, and he had, somehow, shared the strange story with others. It had been a game, apparently. People had left messages for him to get in touch. They had enjoyed playing the game with him so much. He felt oddly ashamed, and did not reply. The rooms he slept in always contained places to sit. Field extensions, mouldable wall units, real couches, and, sometimes, ordinary chairs. Whenever the rooms held chairs, he moved them outside into the corridor or onto the terrace. It was all he could do to keep the memories at bay. "Ah," the woman said in the main bay, "it doesn't really work that way." They stood on a half-constructed starship, on what would eventually be the middle of the engines, watching a huge field unit swing through the air, out of the engineering space behind the bay proper and up towards the skeletal body of the general contact unit. Little lifter tugs manoeuvred the field unit down towards them. "You mean it makes no difference?"
"Not much," the woman said.
She pressed on a little studded lanyard she held in one hand, spoke as though to her shoulder.
I'll take it.
The field unit put them in shadow as it hovered above them. Just another solid slab as far as he could see. It was red, a different colour from the black slickness of the starboard main engine block lower under their feet. She manipulated the lanyard, guiding the huge red block down. Two other people, standing 20 meters away, watched the far end of the unit. The trouble is, the woman said, watching the vast red building brick come slowly down, that even when people do get sick and die young, they're always surprised when they get sick. How many healthy people do you think actually say to themselves, "Hey, I'm healthy today," unless they've just had a serious illness? She shrugged, pressed the lanyard again as the field unit lowered to a couple of centimetres off the engine surface. Stop, she said quietly. Inertia down 5. Check. A line of light flashed on the surface of the engine block. She put one hand on the block and pressed it again. It moved. Down, dead slow, she said. She pressed the block into place. Sorge, all right? She asked. He didn't hear the reply, but the woman obviously did. Okay, positioned. All clear. She looked up as the lifter tugs sailed back towards the engineering space, then back at him. All that's happened is that reality has caught up with the way people always did behave anyway. So, no, you don't feel any wonderful release from debilitating illnesses. She scratched one ear. Except maybe when you think about it. She grinned. I guess in school, when you're seeing how people used to live, how aliens still do live, then it hits home, and I suppose you never really lose that entirely. But you don't spend much time thinking about it. They walked across the black expanse of thoroughly featureless material. Ah, the woman had said when he'd mentioned this. You take a look at it under a microscope. It's beautiful. What did you expect anyway? Cranks? Gears? Tanks full of chemicals? Can't machines build these faster? He asked the woman, looking around the starship shell. Why, of course, she laughed. Then why do you do it? It's fun. You see one of these big mothers sail out those doors for the first time, heading for deep space. 300 people on board, everything working, the mind quite happy, and you think, I'll help build that. The fact that a machine could have done it faster doesn't alter the fact that it was you who actually did it. He said. Learn woodwork, metalwork. They will not make you a carpenter or a blacksmith any more than mastering writing will make you a clerk. Well, you may say, as you wish, the woman said, approaching a translucent hologram of the half-completed ship, where a few other construction workers were standing, pointing inside the model and talking. But have you ever been gliding or swum underwater? Yes, he agreed. The woman shrugged. Yet birds fly better than we do, and fish swim better. Do we stop gliding or swimming because of this? He smiled. I suppose not. You suppose correctly, the woman said. And why? She looked at him, grinning. Because it's fun. She looked at the hollow model of the ship to one side. One of the other workers called to her, pointing at something in the model. She looked at him. Excuse me, will you? He nodded as he backed off. Build well. Thank you. I trust we shall. Oh, he asked. What's this ship to be called? Its mind wishes it to be called the Sweet and Full of Grace, the woman laughed. Then she was deep in discussion with the others. He watched their many sports, tried a few. Most of them he just didn't understand. He swam quite a lot. They seemed to like pools and water complexes. Mostly they swam naked, which he found a little embarrassing. Later he discovered there were whole sections. Villages? Areas? Districts? He wasn't sure how to think of them, where people never wore clothes, just body ornaments. He was surprised how quickly he got used to this behaviour, but never fully joined in. It took him a while to realise that all the drones he saw, even more various in their design than humans were in their physiology, didn't all belong to the ship. Hardly any did, in fact. They had their own artificial brains. He still tended to think of them as computers. They seemed to have their own personalities, too, though he remained sceptical.
Let me put this thought experiment to you, the old drone said, as they played a card game which it had assured him was mostly luck.
They sat, well, the drone floated, under an arcade of delicately pink stone, by the side of a small pool. The shouts of people playing a complicated ball game on the far side of the pool filtered through bushes and small trees to them.
Forget, said the drone, about how machine brains are actually put together. Think about making a machine brain, an electronic computer in the image of a human one. One might start with a few cells, as the human embryo does. These multiply, gradually establish connections. So one would continually add new components and make the relevant, even if one was to follow the exact development of one single human through the various stages, the identical connections. One would, of course, have to limit the speed of the messages transmitted down those connections to a tiny fraction of their normal electronic speed, but that would not be difficult, nor would having these neuron-like components act like their biological equivalents internally, firing their own messages according to the types of signal they received. All this could be done comparatively simply. By building up in this gradual way, you could mimic exactly the development of a human brain, and you could mimic its output. Just as an embryo can experience sound and touch and even light inside the womb, so could you send similar signals to your developing electronic equivalent. You could impersonate the experience of birth and use any degree of sensory stimulation to fool this device into thinking it was feeling, touching, tasting, smelling, hearing and seeing everything your real human was. Or, of course, you might choose not actually to fool it, but always give it just as much genuine sensory input and of the same quality as the human personality was experiencing at any given point. Now, my question to you is this. Where is the difference? The brain of each being works in exactly the same way as the other. They will respond to stimuli with a greater correspondence than one finds even between monozygotic twins. But how can one still choose to call one a conscious entity and the other merely a machine? Your brain is made up of matter, Mr. Zakalwe, organized into information handling, processing and storage units by your genetic inheritance and by the biochemistry of first your mother's body and later your own, not to mention your experiences since some short time before your birth until now. An electronic computer is also made up of matter, but organized differently. What is there so magical about the workings of the huge, slow cells of the animal brain that they can claim themselves to be conscious, but would deny a quicker, more finely grained device of equivalent power, or even a machine hobbled so that it worked with precisely the same ponderousness, a similar distinction? "Hmm?" the machine said, its aura field flashing the pink he was beginning to identify as drone amusement. "Unless, of course, you wish to invoke superstition. Do you believe in gods?" He smiled. "I have never had that inclination," he said. "Well then," the drone said, "what would you say? Is the machine in the human image conscious, sentient or not?" He studied his cards. "I'm thinking," he said, and laughed. Sometimes he saw other aliens. Obviously aliens, that is. He was sure that a few of the humans he saw each day were not culture people, though without stopping to ask them, it was impossible to tell. Somebody dressed as a savage or in some obviously non-culture garb was quite possibly just dressing up like that for a laugh or going to a party. But there were some very obviously different species around as well.
"Yes, young man," the alien said.
It had 8 limbs, a fairly distinct head with 2 quite small eyes, curiously flower-like mouthparts, and a large, almost spherical, lightly haired body, coloured red and purple. Its own voice was composed of clicks from its mouth and almost subsonic vibrations from its body. A small amulet did the translating. He asked if he could sit with the alien. It directed him to the seat across the table from it in the cafe, where he had overheard it talking briefly to a passing human about special circumstances.
"It is in layers," the alien said to his question.
"A tiny core of special circumstances, a shell of contact, and a vast, chaotic ecosphere of everything else. Bit like a..." "You come from a planet?" He nodded. The creature glanced at its amulet for a translation of the gesture the man had used. It was not what the culture called nodding. Then said,
"Well, it is like a planet, only the core is tiny, very tiny. And the ecosphere is more disparate and less distinct than the wrapping of atmosphere round a globe. A red giant star might even be a better comparison. But in the end, you will never know them, because you will be like me, in special circumstances, and only ever know them as the great irresistible force behind you. People like you and I are the edge, You will in time come to feel like a tooth on the biggest saw in the galaxy, sir.
The alien's eyes closed. It waggled all its limbs very energetically, and its mouthparts crackled.
Ha, 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 the amulet said primly.
How did you know I was actually involved with special circumstances? He asked, sitting back.
Ah, how much my vanity wishes me to claim I simply guessed, so clever I am. But I heard there was a new recruit coming aboard, the alien told him, and that it was a fairly human basic male. You smell right, if I may use that turn of phrase, and you have just been asking all the right questions.
And you're in SC2?
For 10 standard years now.
Think I should do it? Work for them?
Oh, yes. I imagine it's better than what you left, no?
He shrugged, remembering the blizzard and the ice. I suppose.
You enjoy fighting, yes?
Well, sometimes, he admitted. I'm good at it, so they say. Not that I'm necessarily convinced of that myself.
No one wins all the time, sir, the creature said. Not through skill, anyway. And the culture does not believe in luck, or at the very least, does not believe it is transferable. They must like your attitude, that's all. He.
The alien laughed quietly.
To be good at soldiering, it said, is a great curse, I think, sometimes. Working for these people, at least, relieves one of some of the responsibility. I have never found cause to complain.
The alien scratched its body, looked down, picked something from the hairs around where he would have guessed its belly might be, and ate it.
Of course, you must not expect to be told the truth all the time. You can insist that they do, always, and they will do so, but they may not be able to use you as often as they might like to. Sometimes they need you not to know you are fighting on the wrong side. My advice would be to just do as they ask. Much more exciting.
Are you in it for the excitement?
Partly, and partly because of family honour. SC did something for my people once, and we could not let them steal our honour by accepting nothing in return. I work until that debt is paid off.
How long's that?
Oh, for life, the creature said, sitting back in a gesture he felt reasonably justified in translating a surprise. Until I die, of course. But who cares? As I say, it's fun. Here.
It banged its drink bowl on the table to attract a passing tray.
Let's have another drink. See who gets drunk first.
You have more legs, he grinned. I think I might fall over more easily.
Ah, but the more the legs, the bigger the tangle.
Fair enough. He waited for a fresh glass.
To one side of them was a small terrace and the bar, to the other a gulf of airy space. The ship, the GSV, went on beyond its apparent boundaries. Its hull was pierced multitudinously by terraces, balconies, walkways, open windows and open bay doors. Surrounding the vessel proper was an immense ellipsoid bubble of air, held inside dozens of different fields, which together made up the vehicle's real, though insubstantial, hull. He took up the recharged glass when it arrived and watched a puttering, piston-engined, paper-winged hang glider zip past the terrace. He waved at the pilot, then shook his head.
To the culture, he said, raising his glass to the alien. It matched his gesture. To its total lack of respect for all things majestic.
Agreed, the alien said, and together they drank. The alien was called Chori, he found out later. It was only due to a chance remark that he discovered Chori was a female, which at the time seemed hilariously funny. He woke up the next morning, lying soaked, as well as soused, half underneath a small waterfall in one of the Ak section valleys. Chori was suspended from a nearby railing by all 8 leg hooks, making a sporadic clattering noise that he decided was snoring. The first night he spent with a woman, he thought she was dying. He thought he'd killed her. She seemed to climax at almost the same time as he did, but then apparently had a seizure, screaming, clutching at him. He had an awful, sickening idea that despite the seeming similarity of their physiology,
His race and the mongrel species that was the culture were somehow quite different, and for a few ghastly moments entertained the idea that his seed was like acid inside her. It felt like she was trying to break his back with her arms and legs. He tried to pull himself away from her, calling her name, trying to see what was wrong, what he had done, what he could do.
"What's wrong?" she gasped.
"What? With me? Nothing. What's wrong with you?" She made a sort of shrugging motion, looked puzzled.
"I came, that's all. What's the... oh."
She put one hand to her mouth, eyes wide.
"I forgot. I'm sorry, you're not... oh, dear."
She giggled.
"How embarrassing."
"What?"
"Well, we just... you know, it takes... it goes on... longer, you know."
He didn't think he had quite believed what he had heard about the culture's altered physiology until then. He hadn't accepted that they had changed themselves so. He had not believed that they really had chosen to extend such moments of pleasure, let alone breed into themselves all the multifarious drug glands that could enhance almost any experience, not least sex. Yet, in a way, it made sense, he told himself. Their machines could do everything else much better than they could. No sense in breeding superhumans for strength or intelligence when their drones and minds were so much more matter and energy efficient at both. But pleasure? Well, that was a different matter. What else was the human form good for? He supposed such single-mindedness was admirable in a way. He took the woman in his arms again.
"Never mind," he said. "Quality, not quantity. Let's try that again, shall we?"
She laughed and took his face in her hands.
"Dedication. That's a good quality in a man."
The cry in the summer house that had attracted.
"Hello, old chap."
Tanned hands on the pale hips. He was away 5 nights, just wandering. As far as he could tell, he never crossed his own trail and never visited the same section twice. He ended up with different women on 3 of those nights and, politely, turned down one young man.
"Any more at your ease, Shiradanin?"
Smar asked him, stroking up the pool ahead of him. She turned on her back to look at him. He swam after her.
"Well, I've stopped offering to pay for things in bars." "That's a start."
"It was a very easy habit to break."
"Par for the course. That all?"
"Well, also, your women are very friendly."
"So are the men."
Smar arched one eyebrow.
"The life here seems... idyllic." "Well, you have to like crowds, perhaps."
He looked round the almost deserted pool complex.
"That's relative, I suspect."
And thought, "The garden. The garden. They have made their life in its image."
"Why?" Smar smiled. "Are you tempted to stay?"
"Not even slightly," he laughed. "I go crazy here, or slip forever into one of your shared dream games. I need... more."
"But will you take it from us?"
Smar said, stopping, treading water.
"Do you want to work with us?"
"Everybody seems to think I should. They believe you're fighting the good fight. It's just that I get suspicious when everybody agrees about something." Smar laughed.
"How much would it matter if we weren't fighting the good fight, Shiradanin? If all we were offering was pay and excitement?"
"I don't know," he admitted. "It would make it even harder. I'd like to believe, to finally know, to finally be able to prove that I was..." He shrugged, grinned.
"Doing good."
Smar sighed. In the water, this meant that she bobbed up, then sank down a little.
"Who knows, Zakalwey? We don't know that. We think we're right. We even think we can prove it. But we can never be sure. There are always arguments against us. There is no certainty, least of all in special circumstances where the rules are different."
"I thought the rules were meant to be the same for everybody."
"They are, but in special circumstances, we deal in the moral equivalent of black holes, where the normal laws, the rules of right and wrong that people imagine apply everywhere else in the universe, break down. Beyond those metaphysical event horizons, there exist... special circumstances."
She smiled. "That's us. That's our territory, our domain. To some people, he said, that might sound like just a good excuse for bad behaviour. Smar shrugged. And perhaps they would be right. Maybe that is all it is. She shook her head, pulled one hand through her long, wet hair. But if nothing else, at least we need an excuse. Think how many people need none at all. She swam off. He watched her stroke powerfully away through the water for a moment. One of his hands went, without him really realizing it, to a small puckered scar on his chest, just over where his heart was, and rubbed it, while he frowned, staring at the glittering, unsteady surface of the water. Then he swam after the woman. He spent a couple of years on the size isn't everything, and on a few of the planets, rocks, habitats and orbitals it stopped at. He was being trained and learning to use some of the new abilities he had let them give him. When he eventually left the craft to go on his first tour of duty for the culture, a series of missions which culminated in him taking the Chosen to the perfumed palace on the cliff, it was on a ship just starting its second tour of duty. The general contact unit, sweet and full of grace. He never saw Chori again, and heard that she'd been killed on active service some 15 years later. He was told this news while they were regrowing his body on the GSV Congenital Optimist after he'd been beheaded on, and then rescued from, a planet called Falls. Chapter 11. He crouched behind the parapet, at the far edge of the old observatory from the single approaching plane. Behind him, down a steep slope, were bushes and trees and a collection of roofless overgrown buildings. He watched the aircraft come closer, checked for more coming from other directions, but couldn't find any. Inside the suit, watching the transmitted view, he frowned as the aircraft came closer, slowing all the time, its obese, arrowhead shape silhouetted against the sunset as it approached. He watched it drop slowly towards the observatory platform. A ramp hinged from the craft's belly, three legs flexed out. He took some effector readings from the machine, then shook his head, ducked and ran back down the slope. Soldrin was sitting in one of the ruined buildings. He looked surprised when the suited figure entered through the creeper-choked doorway.
"Yes, Schradeneaten?"
"It's a civilian craft," he said, pushing the faceplate up. He was grinning. "I don't think it's looking for us after all. Might still provide an escape route, though." He shrugged. "Worth a try." He gestured back at the slope. "You coming along?" Soldrin Beishai looked through the dusk at the matte black figure in the doorway. He had been sitting here wondering what he ought to do, and had not yet come up with any answers. Part of him just wanted to get back to the peace and quiet and certainty of the university library, where he could live happily without fuss, ignore the world and immerse himself in the old books, trying to understand ancient ideas and histories, hoping to make sense of them one day, and perhaps explain his own ideas, try to point out the lessons of these elder histories, perhaps make people think again about their own times and ideologies. For a time, for a long time there, it had seemed entirely and definitely the most worthwhile and productive thing he could do. But he was not sure of that any longer. Perhaps, he thought, there were more important things to be done which he could have a hand in. Perhaps he ought to go with Zakalwe as the man and the culture wanted. Could he just relapse back into his studies after this? Zakalwe, coming back from the past, as rash and brash as ever. Ubrel, could she really have been? Just acting a part? Making him feel very old and foolish now, but angry as well, and the whole cluster drifting rudderless towards the rocks all over again. Did he have any right not to try and do something, even if the culture was wrong about his stature in the civilization? He didn't know. He could see that Zakalwe had tried to appeal to his vanity, but what if even half of what he said was true? Was it right to sit back and just let things happen, however much it might be the easiest, least stressful course? If there was a war, and he knew he'd done nothing, how would he feel afterwards? "Damn you, Zakalwe," he thought. He stood up. "I'm still thinking," he said, "but let's see how far you can get." "Good man." The suited vigor's voice betrayed no obvious trace of emotion.
Extremely sorry for the delay, gentle people. It really wasn't within our control. Some sort of traffic control panic, but do let me apologize again on behalf of Heritage Tours. Well, here we are. A bit later than we expected, but isn't that a pretty sunset? The very famous Skometran Observatory. At least 4,500 years of history have been played out beneath your feet here, gentle people. I'm going to have to fairly rattle through it to tell it all to you in the time we have here, so listen close.
The aircraft hovered, a G-field buzzing, just above the western edge of the observatory platform. Its legs hung, dangling in mid-air, apparently extended merely as a precaution. About 40 people had disembarked from it down the belly ramp and now stood around one of the stone instrument plinths while an eager young tour guide talked to them. He watched through the stone balustrade, scanning the group with the suit's built-in effector and watching the results on the visor screen head-up. 30-plus of the people were carrying what were in effect terminals, links to the planet's communications net. The suit's computer covertly interrogated the terminals through the effector. Two of the terminals were switched on. One receiving a sports broadcast, another receiving music. The rest were on standby. "Suit," he whispered. Not that even Soldrin right beside him could have heard him, let alone the people in the tourist group. "I want to disable those terminals, quietly, to stop them from transmitting."
"Two receiving terminals are transmitting location code," the suit said.
"Can I disable their transmit function without altering their present location code function or their present reception?"
"Yes."
"Right. The priority being preventing any further new signals, disable all the terminals."
"Disabling all 34 non-culture personal comnet terminals within range. Confirm."
"Confirmed, damn it. Do it."
"Order carried out."
He watched the head-up alter as the internal power states of the terminals sank back to near zero. The tour guide was leading the people across the stone plateau of the old observatory, towards where he and Beishai were, and away from the hovering aircraft. He shoved the suit faceplate up, looked round at the other man.
"Okay, let's go. Quietly."
He went first through the undergrowth, between the crowding trees. It was quite dark under the half-fallen foliage, and Beishai stumbled a couple of times, but they made relatively little noise as they trod the carpet of dead leaves round two sides of the observatory platform. When they were under the aircraft, he scanned it with a suit effector.
"You beautiful little machine," he breathed,
watching the results come up. The aircraft was automatic and very stupid. A bird probably had a more complicated brain. "Suit, patch into the aircraft. Assume control without letting anybody else know."
"Assuming covert control jurisdiction of single aircraft within range. Confirm."
"Confirmed. And stop asking me to confirm everything."
"Control jurisdiction assumed. Lapsing confirmatory instruction protocols. Confirm."
"Good grief. Confirmed."
"Confirm protocol lapsed."
He considered just floating up, holding Beishai, into the craft. But even though the aircraft's own AG would probably mask the signal his suit gave off, it might not. He glanced up the steep slope, then turned to Beishai and whispered,
"Give me your hand. We're going up."
The old man did as he asked. They went steadily up the slope, the suit kicking footholds in the earth. They stopped at the balustrade. The aircraft blocked out the evening sky above them, yellow light spilling from the belly entrance above the ramp, faintly illuminating the nearer stone instruments. He checked on the tour group while Beishai got his breath back. The tourists were at the far side of the observatory. The guide was shining a flashlight at some ancient piece of stonework. He stood up.
"Let's go," he told Beishai, who straightened.
They stepped over the balustrade, walked to the ramp and up into the aircraft. He followed Beishai. He watched the rear view on the helmet screen, but couldn't tell whether anybody in the tour group had noticed them or not.
"Suit, close the ramp," he told the suit,
as he and Beishai entered the single large space of the craft's interior. It was ornately luxurious, its walls slung with hangings, and its deeply carpeted floor dotted with large chairs and couches. There was an auto bar at one end, while the opposite wall was a single huge screen, presently displaying the last of the sunset. The ramp chimed and hissed as it came up. "Suit, retract legs," he said, hinging the suit faceplate back. Happily,
The suit was smart enough to realize he meant the aircraft's legs, not its own. It had occurred to him that somebody might just be able to leap onto one of the craft's legs from the observatory balustrade. Suit. Adjust aircraft altitude. Up 10 meters. The light buzzing noise around them changed, then settled back to what it had been before. He watched Beishai take off his heavy jacket, then looked round the interior of the craft. The effector said there was nobody else aboard, but he wanted to make sure. "Let's see where this thing was headed next," he said, as Beishai sat down on a long couch, sighing and stretching. "Suit, the aircraft's next destination."
"Gibline Space Terminal," the clipped voice told him.
"That sounds perfect. Take us there, Suit, and make it look as legal and normal as possible."
"Underway," the suit said. "ETA 40 minutes.
The craft's background noise altered, climbing in pitch. The floor moved just a little. The screen on the far side of the large cabin showed them moving out across the wooded hills, rising into the air. He took a walk round the craft, confirming there was nobody else aboard, then sat by Beishai, who he thought looked very tired. It had been a long day, he supposed. "You all right?"
"I'm glad to be sitting down, I'll say that."
Beishai kicked off his boots. "Let me get you a drink, Soldrin," he said, taking off the helmet and heading for the bar. "Suit," he said suddenly, struck by an idea. "You know one of the culture's downlink numbers in Solitol?"
"Yes."
"Connect with one via the aircraft." He bent down, looking at the autobar. "And how does this work?"
"The autobar is voice active. Zakalwe."
Smar's voice cut across that of the suit, making him start. He straightened.
"Where are?"
the woman's voice said, then paused.
"Oh, you've got yourself an aircraft, have you?"
"Yes," he said. He looked across to where Beishai was watching him. "On our way to Gipline Port." "So what happened? Where's that module? And Smar, I'm hurt. You haven't called. You haven't written, sent flowers. Is Beishai all right?" Smar said urgently. "Solrin's fine," he told her, smiling at the other man. "Suit, get this autobar to fix us a couple of refreshing but strong drinks."
"He's okay." "Good," the woman sighed.
The autobar made clicking, gurgling noises.
"We haven't called," Smar said, "because if we had, we'd have let them know where you were. We lost the tight link when the capsule got blasted. Zakalwe, that was ridiculous. It was pure chaos after the capsule wasted the truck in the flower market and you downed that fighter. You're lucky you made it as far as you did. Where is the capsule anyway?"
"Back at the observatory, Srimetran," he said, looking down as a hatch opened in the autobar. He took the tray with the two drinks on it over to Beishai, sat down at his side. "Smar, say hello to Tsoldrin Beishai," he said, handing the other man his drink.
"Mr. Beishai?" Smar's voice said from the suit.
"Hello?"
Beishai said.
"Pleased to talk to you, Mr. Beishai. I do hope Mr. Zakalwe is treating you all right. Are you well?"
"Tired, but hail."
"I trust Mr. Zakalwe has found time to communicate to you the seriousness of the political situation in the cluster."
"He has,"
Beishai said.
I am certainly considering doing what you ask, and for the moment have no urge to return to Solitor."
"I see," Smar said. "I appreciate what you say. I'm sure Mr. Zakalwe will do all he can to keep you safe and well while you're deliberating. Won't you, Sharadanin?"
"Of course, Dizzyed. Now, where's that module?"
"Stuck under the cloud tops of Sorarath, where it was before. Thanks to your Nova profile escapades down there, everything's on maximum alert. We can't move anything without being seen, and if we're seen to be interfering, we might start the war all by ourselves. Describe where that capsule is again. We're going to have to passive spot it from the microsatellite and then blast it from up here to remove the evidence. Shit, this is messy, Zakalwe."
"Well, pardon me," he said. He drank again. "The capsule's under a large yellow-leaf deciduous tree between 80 and 130 meters northeast of the observatory. Oh, and the plasma rifle's about 20 to 40 meters due west."
"You lost it?"
Smar sounded incredulous.
"Threw it away in a fit of pique,"
he admitted, yawning.
"It got effectorized."
"Told you it belonged in a museum,"
another voice interrupted. "Shut up, Scaffin Amtiscor," he said.
So, Smar, what now?
Gipline space terminal, I suppose, the woman replied. We'll see if we can book you on something outgoing, for Imprin or nearby. At worst, you've got a civilian trip ahead of you of weeks at least. If we're lucky, they'll stand down the alert and the module can sneak out and rendezvous. Either way, though, the war may be a little closer thanks to what happened in Solitol today. Just think about that, Sir Calway. The channel closed.
She sounds unhappy with you, Shoradnin, Beishai said.
He shrugged.
No change there, he sighed.
I'm really most terribly sorry, gentle people. This has never happened before. Never. I really am sorry. I just can't understand it. I'll try.
The young man hit buttons on his pocket terminal.
Hello? Hello? Hello?
He shook it, banged it with the heel of his hand.
This is just... This has never happened before. It really hasn't.
He looked apologetically up at the people in the tour group, clustered round the single light. Most of the people were looking at him. A few were trying their own terminals with no more success than he, and a couple were watching the western sky as though the last red smudge there would give up the aircraft that had so mysteriously decided to leave of its own accord.
Hello? Hello? Anybody, please reply.
The young man sounded almost in tears. The very last dreg of light left the sunset sky. Moonglow lit up some thinner patches of cloud. The flashlight flickered.
Anybody at all, please reply. Oh, please.
Scaffan Amtiskor got back in touch a few minutes later to say that he and Beishai had cabins reserved on a clipper called the Osom Imananish, heading for the Breskial system, just 3 light-years from Imprin. The hope was that the module would get to them before that. It would probably have to. Their trail would almost certainly be picked up.
It might be an idea for Mr. Beishai to alter his appearance, the drone's smooth voice told them.
He looked up at the wall drapes.
I suppose we could try and make some clothes out of stuff here, he said doubtfully.
The aircraft baggage hold might prove a more fruitful source of attire, the drone's voice purred, and told him how to open the floor hatch.
He surfaced with 2 suitcases, wrenched them open.
Clothes, he said.
He took some out. They looked sufficiently unisex.
And you'll have to lose your suit and weaponry, too, the drone said.
What?
You'll never get on board a ship with that stuff, Sir Calway, even with our help. You've to pack it all in something. One of those cases would be ideal, and leave it in the port. We'll try and pick it up once the heat's off.
But...
Beishai himself suggested they shaved his head when they were discussing how to disguise him. The last use the wonderfully sophisticated combat suit was put to was as a razor. Then he took it off. They both changed into the rather loud but thankfully loose-fitting clothes. The craft landed. The space terminal was a wilderness of concrete lined off like a game board by the lifts that took craft down to and up from the handling facilities. Tight beam established again, the earring terminal could whisper to him, guide him and Beishai. But he felt naked without the suit. They stepped from the aircraft into a hangar. Pleasantly forgettable music tinkled. Nobody met them. They could hear a distant alarm. The earring terminal indicated which door to take. They moved along a staff-only corridor, through 2 security doors which swung open for them even before they got to them. Then, after a pause, came out into a huge crowded concourse full of people, screens, kiosks and seats. Nobody noticed them, because a moving walkway had just slammed to a stop, toppling dozens of people on top of each other. A security camera in the left luggage area swung up to look at the ceiling for the minute it took them to deposit the suitcase with the suit in it. The instant they'd gone, the camera resumed its slow sweeping. More or less the same happened when they picked up their tickets at the appropriate desk. Then, while they were walking along another corridor, they saw a party of armed security guards enter from the other end. He just kept on walking. He sensed Beishai hesitate at his side. He turned, smiled easily at the other man, and when he turned back, the guards were stopped, the leading guard holding one hand to his ear and looking at the floor. He nodded, turned and pointed to a side corridor. The guards set off down it.
We're not just being incredibly lucky, I take it, Beishai muttered.
He shook his head.
Not unless you count it as incredibly lucky that we've got a near-military-standard electromagnetic effector controlled by a hyperfast starship mind working this entire port like an arcade game from a light year or so off. No. They were passed through a VIP channel to the small shuttle that would take them to the orbiting station. The final security check was the only one the ship couldn't rig. A man with practiced eyes and hands. He seemed happy they had nothing dangerous on them. The earring jabbed his ear as they passed down another corridor. More X-rays and a strong magnetic field, both manually controlled. Double-checking. The shuttle flight was relatively uneventful. In the station, they passed across one transit lounge, in something of a commotion due to a man with a direct neural implant seemingly having a fit on the floor, straight into a final security check. In the corridor between the lounge lock and the ship, he heard Smar's voice, tiny in his ear. "That's it, Zakalwe. Can't type beam on the ship without being spotted. We'll only contact in a real emergency. Use the Solitol phone link if you want to talk, but remember it'll be monitored. Goodbye. Good luck." And then he and Beishai were through another airlock and on the clipper Osom Imananish, which would take them into interstellar space. He spent the hour or so before departure walking round the clipper, just checking it all out, so that he knew where everything was. The speaker system and most of the visible screens announced their departure. The clipper drifted, then dawdled, then raced away from the station. It swung away past the sun and the gas giant Sorarath. Sorarath was where the module was having to keep hidden, 100 kilometres deep, in the vast perpetual storm that was the mighty planet's atmosphere. An atmosphere that would be plundered, mined, stripped and altered by the humanists if they had their way. He watched the gas giant fall astern, wondered who was really right and wrong, and felt an odd helplessness. He was passing through the bustle of a small bar on his way to check on Beishai, when he heard a voice behind him say,
"Ah, sincere hellos and things, Mr. Starabind, isn't it?"
He turned slowly. It was the small doctor from the Scar party. The little man stood at the crowded bar, beckoning to him. He walked over, squeezing between the chattering passengers.
"Doctor, good day."
The little man nodded.
"Stap Angarda's Linatere. But call me Stap."
"With pleasure, and even relief." He smiled.
"And please, call me Sherad." "Well, small cluster, isn't it? May I buy you a drink?"
He flashed his toothy grin, which, caught in a small spotlight above the bar, glared quite startlingly.
"What an excellent idea."
They found a small table wedged up against one bulkhead. The doctor wiped his nose, adjusted his immaculate suit.
"So, Sherad, what brings you along on this little jaunt?"
"Well, actually, Stap," he said quietly, "I'm travelling sort of incognito, so I'd appreciate it if you didn't broadcast my name, you know."
"Absolutely," Dr. Stapp said, nodding fiercely.
He glanced round conspiratorially, leaned closer.
"My discretion is exemplary. I've had to travel quietly," his eyebrows waggled, "myself on occasion. You just let me know if I can be of any help."
"You're very kind." He raised his glass. They drank to a safe voyage.
"Are you going to the end of the line to Breskial?"
Stapp asked. He nodded.
"Yes, myself and a business associate."
Dr. Stapp nodded, grinning.
"Ah, a business associate. Ah.
No, Doctor, not a business associate. A business associate. A gentleman, and quite elderly, and in a different cabin. Would that all three descriptions were their opposite, of course."
"Ha, quite," the doctor said.
"Another drink?"
"You don't think he knows anything?"
Beishai asked.
"What's to know?" he shrugged.
He glanced at the screen on the door of Beishai's cramped cabin.
"Nothing on the news?"
"Nothing," Beishai said. "They mentioned an all-port security exercise, but nothing directly about you or me."
"Well, we probably aren't in any more danger because the docks are aboard than we were already."
"How much is that?"
"Too much. They're bound to work out what happened eventually. We'll never get to Breskial before they do."
"Then?"
"Then, unless I can think of something, the culture either has to let us be taken back or take this ship over, which is going to be tricky to explain and bound to remove some of your credibility.
If I decide to do as you ask, Shah Hatanin.
He looked at the other man, sitting alongside him on the narrow bed.
Yeah, if.
He prowled the ship. The clipper seemed cramped and crowded. He'd got too used to culture vessels, he supposed. There were plans of the ship available on screen, and he studied them. But they were really just for people to find their way about, and provided little useful information on how the ship might be taken over or disabled. Judging from watching the crew when they appeared, entry to crew-only areas was by voice and, or, handprint match. There was little flammable on board, nothing explosive, and most of the circuitry was optical rather than electronic. Doubtless the xenophobe could make the clipper, Ossum Imananish, dance and sing with the effector equivalent of one hand tied behind its back from somewhere in the next stellar system. But without the combat suit or a weapon, he was going to have a tough job trying to do anything, if and when it came to it. Meanwhile, the clipper crawled through space. Beishai stayed in his cabin, catching up on the news via the screen and sleeping.
"I seem to have swapped one subtle form of imprisonment for another, Shah Adanin," he observed the day after they left, as the other man brought him supper.
"Soldrin, don't go cabin crazy. If you want to go out, go out. It's a little safer this way, but, well, only a little."
"Well," Soldrin said, taking the tray and lifting the cover to inspect the contents. "For now, it's easy enough to treat the news and current affairs casts as my research material, so I do not feel unduly confined."
He set the cover aside.
"But a couple of weeks might be asking rather too much, Shah Adanin."
"Don't worry," he said dejectedly. "I doubt it'll come to that."
"Ah, Sherad."
The small, fussy shape of Dr. Stapp sidled up to him a day later, while people were watching a magnified view of an impressive gas giant in a nearby system slide past on the principal lounge main screen. The small doctor took his elbow.
"I'm having a small private party this evening in the Starlight Lounge. One of my, special parties, you know. I wondered if you and your hermit-like business partner might like to participate."
"They let you aboard with that thing?"
he laughed. "Shh, good sir," the doctor said, pulling the other man away from the press of people. "I have a long-standing arrangement with the shipping line. My machine is recognized as being of primary medical importance."
"Sounds expensive. You must have to charge a lot, doctor."
"There is, of course, a small consideration involved, but well within the means of most cultured people, and I can assure you of some very exclusive company and complete discretion as ever."
"Thank you for the offer, Doctor, but I'm afraid not."
"It really is the opportunity of a lifetime. You are most lucky to have the chance a second time."
"I'm sure.
Perhaps if it occurs a third time."
"Excuse me."
He patted Stapp on the shoulder. "Oh, shall I see you for drinks this evening?"
The doctor shook his head.
"I'll be setting up, preparing, I'm afraid," Sherad.
He looked somehow plaintive.
"It is a great opportunity," he said toothily.
"Oh, I'm well aware of that, Dr. Stapp."
"You're a wicked man."
"Thank you. It's taken years of diligent practice."
"I bet."
"Oh, no. You're going to tell me you're not wicked at all. I can see it in your eyes."
"Yes, yes, it's there, purity. I recognize the symptoms. But,"
he put one hand on her forearm, "don't worry, it can be cured."
She pushed him away, but only with the softest of pressures. "You're terrible."
The hand that had pushed him away lingered just for a moment on his chest.
"You're bad."
"I confess. You have seen into my soul." He looked round for a second as the background noise of the ship altered. He smiled back at the lady.
"But, it gives me such succour to confess to one so close to a goddess-like beauty."
She laughed throatily, her slender neck exposed as she put her head back.
"Do you normally get anywhere with this line?"
she asked, shaking her head. He looked hurt, shook his head sadly.
"Oh, why are beautiful women so cynical these days?"
Then he saw her gaze shift to somewhere behind him. He turned.
"Yes, officer?"
he said to one of the two junior officers he found standing behind him. Both had guns in open holsters.
"Mr. Sherad?"
the young man said. He watched the young officer's eyes and suddenly felt sick. The man knew. They'd been traced. Somebody, somewhere, had put the numbers together and come up with the right answer.
"Yes,"
he said, grinning rather stupidly.
"You guys want a drink?"
He laughed, looked round at the woman.
"No, thank you, sir. Would you come with us, please?"
"What's the matter?"
he said, sniffing, then draining his glass. He wiped his hands on the lapels of his jacket.
"Captain needs some help steering the ship, yeah?"
He laughed, slid off his bar stool, turned to the woman, took her hand and kissed it.
"My dear lady, I bid you farewell until we meet again."
He put both hands to his chest.
"But always remember this. There is forever a piece of my heart that belongs to you."
She smiled uncertainly. He laughed loudly, turned and bumped into the barstool.
"Whoops," he said.
"This way, Mr. Shoad," the first one said.
"Yeah, yeah, just wherever."
He'd hoped that they'd take him into the crew-only section, but when they got into the small lift, they pressed for the lowest deck, stores, non-vacuum luggage, and the brig.
"I think I'm going to be sick," he said, as soon as the doors closed.
He bent over, retched, forcing out the last few drinks. One jumped out of the way to keep his shiny boots clean. The other, he sensed, was bending down, putting one hand to his back. He stopped throwing up, slammed one elbow up into the man's nose. He crashed back into the elevator's rear doors. The second man hadn't quite recovered his balance. He straightened and punched him straight in the face. The second one folded, knees then backside, hammering into the floor. The lift chimed, stopped between decks, its weight limit alarm triggered by all the commotion. He thumped the topmost button and the lift started up. He took the guns from the two unconscious officers. Neural stunners. He shook his head. The elevator chimed again. The floor they'd left. He stepped forward, stuffing the two stun guns into his jacket as he braced his feet in the far corners of the small space, straddling the two men, and pressed his hands against the doors. He grunted with the effort of holding the doors closed, but eventually the elevator gave up the struggle. Still holding the doors with both hands, he twisted his body until he got his head to the topmost button and pressed it with his forehead. The lift hummed upwards again. When the doors opened, three people stood outside on the private lounge level. They looked at the two unconscious guards and the small, watery pool of vomit. Then he zapped them with the stun guns and they fell. He pulled one of the officers half out of the elevator so the lift couldn't close its doors and used a stun gun on both men too. The Starlight Lounge door was closed. He pressed the button, looking back down the corridor where the lift doors pulsed gently against the fallen officer's body like some unsubtle lover. There was a distant chime and a voice said, "Please clear the doors. Please clear the doors."
"Yes," said the door to the Starlight Lounge.
"Stop, it's Shirad. I changed my mind."
"Excellent."
The door opened. He went quickly inside, hit the shut button. The modest lounge was full of drug smoke, low light and mutilated people. Music played and all eyes, not all of them in their sockets, turned to him. The doctor's tall grey machine was over near the bar, where a couple of people were serving. He got the doctor between him and the others, stuck the stun gun under the little man's chin. "Bad news, Stapp. These things can be fatal at close range, and this one's on maximum. I need your machine. I'd prefer to have your cooperation, too, but I can get by without it. I'm very serious and in a terrible hurry, so what's it to be?" Stapp made a gurgling noise. "3, he said, pressing the stun gun a little harder into the little doctor's neck. 2.
"All right, this way."
He let him go, following Stapp across the floor to the tall machine he used for his strange trade. He kept his hands together, stun pistols hidden up each sleeve. He nodded to a few people as they passed. He spotted a clear line of fire to somebody on the far side of the room, just for an instant. He zapped them. They fell spectacularly onto a laden table. While everybody was looking there, he and Stapp, prodded once to keep going when the crash came from the distant table, got to the machine. "Excuse me," he said to one of the bar girls. "Would you help the doctor?" He nodded behind the bar. "He wants to move the machine through there, don't you, Doc?" They entered the small storeroom behind the bar. He thanked the girl outside, closed the door, locked it, and shifted a pile of containers in front of it. He smiled at the alarmed-looking doctor. "See that wall behind you, Stapp?" The doctor's gaze flicked that way. "We're going through it, Doc, with your machine."
"You can't! You..."
He put the stun gun against the man's forehead. Stapp closed his eyes. A corner of handkerchief protruding from a breast pocket trembled. "Stapp, I think I know how that machine must work to do what it does. I want a cutting field, a slicer that'll take molecular bonds apart. If you won't do it, and right now, I'll put you out and try it myself. And if I get it wrong and fuse the fucker, you're going to have some very, very unhappy customers out there. They might even do what you've done to them, but without the old machine here. Hmm?" Stapp swallowed.
"Mm,"
he began. One of his hands moved slowly towards his jacket.
"My tool kit."
He took the wallet of tools out, turned shakily to the machine, and opened a panel. The door behind them chimed. He found some sort of chromed bar utensil on a shelf, moved the containers in front of the door aside. Stapp looked round, but saw the gun was still pointed at him and turned back, and jammed the piece of metal into the gap between the sliding door and its housing. The door gave an outraged chirp, and a red light blinked urgently on the open-close button. He slid the containers back again. "Hurry up, Stapp," he said.
"I'm doing all I can,"
the little doctor yelped. The machine made a deep, buzzing noise. Blue light played around a cylindrical section about a meter from the floor. He looked at the section, eyes narrowing.
"What are you hoping to do?"
the doctor said, voice shaking. "Just keep working, Doc. You have half a minute before I try doing it myself." He looked over the doctor's shoulder, saw him fiddling with a circular control mapped out in degrees. All he could hope to do was get the machine going and then attack whatever parts of the ship he could. Disable it somehow. All ships tended to be complicated, and to a degree, the cruder a ship was, paradoxically, the more complicated it was too. He just had to hope he could hit something vital without blowing the thing up.
Nearly ready,
the doctor said. He looked nervously backwards, one shaking finger going towards a small red button.
"Okay, Doc," he told the trembling man,
looking suspiciously at the blue light playing around the cylindrical section. He squatted down level with the doctor.
"Go on," he nodded.
The doctor swallowed. "It might be better if you stood back over there.